To be honest, the quality of appreciative joy for a long time was my least favorite of the heart practices. And I think that was just because I wasn't very good at it. In Buddhism, there's a really fun personality typology that says that we all incline toward one of the three of the great poisons, or the deep roots of distress in the psyche. Right? The three poisons are greed or grasping or attachment or lust, aversion or hatred, pushing away, and delusion or confusion or ignorance. And the way that they play out, there are three essentially reactive positions, right? That in the face of life or stimulus, things that happen, folks who are what we would call a greed type, they see what's delightful in the thing and they want more of it. Folks who are what we call aversive types, which is myself, in part, see the negative and want less of it. And folks who are deluded or delusion types don't really hook on to either thing and tend to be a little bit kind of either spacey or just a little bit separate from things, or just not quite clear about what's what, not really connecting with the object. And the story often given to demonstrate this, or the thought puzzle, is you walk into a room you've never been in before. Maybe it's a party or a little gathering or something. And one kind of person walks in and says, "Oh, what a nice space. I love those curtains. That looks like a really nice bunch of people. I would love to get to know them." And what they're doing is they're ignoring all the things they don't like. They don't even notice them, right? It's like, oh, there's some dishes and things. They didn't notice it. They're just like, oh, you know, the lampshade choice was a little suspect. But they didn't notice it. They were like, yeah, nice curtain, nice drapes. The aversive type does the opposite. Walks in and is like, who designed this? Those people don't look very fun. I'll just wash some dishes. Oh my God, nobody's been washing that. I'm leaving. That's the aversive type. And the deluded type, they walk in, someone's like, hey, what do you think of the party? And they're like, huh? Oh, it's all right, I guess. I didn't really notice. I was kind of somewhere else. So as an aversive type, it was hard for me to connect with appreciative joy. I was really good at compassion, because clearly there's a lot to compash about in this world. There's so much suffering that was visible and obvious and palpable, and I could sense in myself as well. And it turned out that I was also really good at equanimity, because one of the things that you're good at if you don't like anything is not caring, which is not equanimity. But with a little practice, you can kind of sidestep into a little equanimity and be like, well, you know, it's okay. You get used to tolerating discomfort, and then everything's okay. There's a lot of discomfort. But appreciative joy was like, for me, it was a little like, yeah. But in a certain way, when it finally clicked, and to be honest, it only clicks sometimes for me. It kind of comes and goes with my mood. But sometimes I'll do it, and I'll get that sense. And the sense is sublime in a particular way. And it's different than any of the other states. It's different than basic kindness also. It's not just you know, oh, you know, I feel warm toward you or all beings or whoever. Like, may they be well. But there's a particular brightness to it that has a wisdom quality, like they all do. And the brightness is that when my system comes into contact with well-being, with something that's going well, what it feels like is that it's almost like this is a sign to my deep being that things are okay, that we're safe, that I can kind of let down my guard. One of the things we do in the face of pleasure, if we can receive it is we can relax that kind of nervous system vigilance, the part that is alert for danger, the part that especially if there's been trauma in the system, can never quite let go, always is alert for what's wrong. And that is probably the same as being an aversive type. Like the typologies probably come from early experience, the way that personality does. That these were early defense mechanisms or strategies for maintaining some kind of equilibrium in the face of challenge. What would it be for a young child to develop the personality that looked for the good in everything, that looked for the beautiful? Oh, that's nice. Oh, that's nice. And it's not just seeing the good in everything, but as a greed type, it's also seeing it and wanting it, right? Oh, that's a beautiful necklace. I want that. Ooh, that person looks lovely. Maybe they could be my friend. Oh my gosh, that's a really nice thing. Ooh, that sounds like a fun vacation. I could go there, right? What is it in the psyche that when presented with the cornucopia of possible experiences is reaching? Likewise, what kind of experience leads to that little pushing away? Like, doesn't sound so good. Vacation is stressful. Jewelry is useless. Food, the taste disappears in 3 seconds. It's kind of boring. People, problematic. The closer you get to them, the harder it is. It's just better to stay away. That's the classic aversive, right? And then what are the conditions that lead to the delusion type? To the, not connecting? All of these can be woven into attachment styles, can be woven into trauma background, as we talked about last month a bit with the trauma work. This means, in a way, that appreciative joy, cultivating the quality that celebrates well-being, means that for greed types, we have to celebrate without grasping. The challenge for folks whose habit is to grasp, when they're in the presence of other people's good fortune, is to not lapse into wanting it for themselves. Right? Oh, whatever it is. Yeah. Oh, that person looks like they're doing so well. I wish I were doing so well. That's a grasping response. Appreciative joy is profoundly generous. That person is doing so well. Bravo! That's awesome. I hope that continues for them. What a good thing. Just straight up, may you be well, and more well, and more well. And for the aversive type, it means bypassing that first flinch of judgment. If someone else is doing well, it definitely means that I'm not. Or it means that they're doing something, that they probably shouldn't be to be doing so well. Or they have too much privilege, or they have whatever they have. I can be critical of it, no matter what it is. It's the skill of the aversive. And so the practice of appreciative joy means I have to bypass that as well and actually relax into celebration. The deluded person, for both compassion and appreciative joy, for all of the Brahmic Viharas, the deluded people are really good at equanimity. But for the others that are more heart juicy, their practice is to connect with what's happening, to not stay in their kind of separate or remove or slightly freezy sometimes space, to use the trauma language. One of the things I think that's so beautiful about appreciative joy as a quality and as a practice is that it leavens or lightens or warms up or moistens the basic renunciate stance of this practice. Right? If we're told in the Noble Truths that grasping is the source of suffering, that, you know, grasping at sense pleasures, grasping at existence. There's some way that we can learn that pleasure is to be feared in a sort of pure renunciate kind of way. Because it so easily inclines toward hooking us or inspiring grasping. And appreciative joy is one of the places in the system where there's a shading of a really important difference in relation to pleasure. And it's not surprising that it's primarily the pleasure of others. Like, you can do appreciative joy practice in relation to your own good fortune, but in a sense that slides into gratitude practice, which is a different thing. And I think what's important about appreciative joy, in an interesting way, it's also possible but curious to do compassion practice for yourself, because in order to do it, you have to stand outside your own suffering a little bit. We talked about this last week a tiny bit. It's true with appreciative joy as well. To cultivate this quality, the Pali word is mudita, appreciative joy, for myself, for my own good fortune, means in a certain way I have to disidentify with it. I have to look at it from a slight distance and say, oh, look at that good fortune, may it increase, without sliding into my good fortune, may I retain it. As soon as I do that, I'm very close to grasping at it. And so the bulk of cultivating it, I think, is really to look outward. And this begins to undo some of the qualities of jealousy and envy. There's a really, there's a cute word that was coined by people in the polyamorous movement who wanted a term for the feeling that you might have when your intimate sweetheart is having a really good time, a really good sexy time with somebody else. And they coined the term compersion. And I don't really like it as a term. Partly because it should be more related to appreciative joy than compassion. And the shift of the root of the word from passio to per seems kind of like, etymologically, it doesn't quite land for me. But that said, it was a quality of heart that needed a word, because previously it was only expressible in the negative, non-jealousy, you know, non-envy, non-possessiveness. So then you could say, oh, I'm happy that you're having a good time with this other person. They could have just used appreciative joy, mudita. The wisdom quality mudita is, like the other qualities, it hinges on the realization of the permeability or emptiness of the self. That when I can see the good fortune in another or in everyone else and celebrate it without grasping, part of what happens is my own system softens around my own well-being or suffering, because I'm not grabbing at other people's experience. I think appreciative joy leads to and supports the wholesome and beautiful kind of renunciation where I let go of wanting more for myself and I celebrate others having more. If I do this to a profound degree, it must rattle the foundations of myself, my sense of self, my sense of isolation or separateness. Because isolation and separateness are always interwoven with scarcity and greed. If I'm separate from you, you might have more than me. Resources are scarce, therefore I'm afraid, or angry, or hateful. And this points to one of the deepest qualities that is an aspect of the self. It's called a fetter in Buddhism. So clearly thought of as a deep hindrance to liberation. And it's called the conceit I am. It's one of the last aspects of bondage to go before full liberation. In other words, you can get very, very, very enlightened, 3 out of 4 stages of enlightenment, and still have this basic sense of being different from others. I am. And the way this manifests is the comparing mind. The mind that's always going around saying, this is better, this is worse. This is preferable, this is not preferable. I like this, I don't like that. I'm better than this, I'm worse than this. I'm the same as this. And the Buddha's teaching on comparison is interesting in that it says this conceit, this quality of conceit, is the quality that's present when you think you're better than something, also when you think you're worse than something, and also when you think you're the same as. So equality conceit is still a conceit. So there's superiority conceit, inferiority conceit, and equality conceit. Because you're still comparing. You're still assessing the relative levels of a thing. And so you're saying, oh, you and I are of equal worth. At the basis of that statement is the idea that we have worth, or some amount of worth that can be measured. And that itself is wrong view. And there's no worth to beings in the Buddhist system. Which doesn't mean that there's a lack of worth. Worth turns out to be a complicated kind of muddy concept. Value. What is value in relation to beings? What's the value of a being? This is a difficult philosophical question that enters into lots of practical issues. The Buddhist system says that the value in being a human being, not the value of a human being in some abstract sense, but the value in having taken a human birth at all, is that this is the ideal place to hear and practice the Dharma, to do liberation teachings. That if you're born in the animal realm, there's too much habit, essentially, energy. The animal life is very repetitive, right? Not so much opportunity to practice the subtler dharmas, perhaps not a need to practice the subtler dharmas, because there's a being embedded in the ecosystem in a way that we might not find the same neuroses of the self and comparison in the animals. I don't know if my cat, when I was growing up, looked at the other cats in the neighborhood and was like, I wish I could jump on fences the way they can. I'm a way better roof howler than them. Right? Maybe he was, you know. My cat was a little funny guy. But it doesn't seem like it. So it might be one of the traditional teachings is that the human realm is the place from which to awaken. A different way to spin this would be the human realm might be the only place that needs awakening. We might be the most deluded. That's not a traditional teaching. But it is traditional to say that at least from the human realm, this is the place where we can practice, and that would be the value or the privilege or the blessing of being born a human. But none of that bears on comparison. And so this thing that we do where we compare ourselves with others or others with others, the comparing mind turns out to be one of the most subtle and poisonous of the hindrances in the mind. It is the thing that holds us as separate from others. And of course, there are aspects of this that are absolutely practical and necessary, right? Differentiation is important. It's important to know who you are, who your people are, who you're not, who your people aren't. the whole conventional world rests on identity and possessions and groupings, and that's all okay. From an early Buddhist perspective, all of that stuff is structure. Those are just structures within which to live. Even if you become a monastic and you take on the structure of, like, I'm in robes and, you know, the householders support me, you're making a differentiation. You say, I observe these vows and I don't break them. All of that is important in practice. All of those are structures within which to operate. But the core quality of comparison, we can start to tune ourselves to in our practice and just notice how much it's present, how often I'm assessing and comparing. And I'll notice that some of those times are useful, right? Sometimes I'm making an assessment of a situation, I'm comparing one thing to another thing, and it's appropriate to do so in order to figure out how best to act. The main places that I think it's valuable to notice comparison or judgment and practice letting it go are when that is particularly kind of value level comparisons or judgments about people and situations, and particularly that involve oneself. And again, those three primary conceits, the superiority conceit, thinking that I'm better than someone or something, inferiority conceit, thinking that I'm worse than, and equality conceit, thinking that I'm the same as. Part of how compassion and appreciative joy, these heart qualities that respond to suffering and well-being with an open heart, with warm feeling, and especially appreciative joy, I think, part of how it undercuts this quality of comparison is that it offers the enthusiasm of my heart without holding back, and it doesn't compare my well-being to theirs. It takes me out of the mindset that says that when someone else is doing well, that becomes a barometer by which to assess how well I'm doing. And what if I could just let that go? Like, stop doing that. That's painful. Because I never come out looking good in relation to that. Right? It's always painful a little bit. If I feel better than what they're doing, I'm on totally judgy. I'm like, they suck, blah, blah, blah. That's painful. That's totally annoying. I'm not happy when I'm doing that. And it never really bucks up my sense of self-worth, although it pretends to. The other side is equally painful. Oh my God, they're so awesome, and I'm so lowly and so bad and so un-whatever. That's painful. First of all, it's projection. They're probably not as lofty as you think. Second of all, it's internalized oppression. You don't suck as badly as you think. Basically, you're wrong about both, and you've created more division. And equality conceit is subtle and challenging, right? Because it's, first of all, it's unmaintainable. If we're the same, we have to work hard to maintain sameness, right? If you do something awesome, what, do you suddenly like bump up out of the plateau of sameness and suddenly I have to do something awesome to keep us the same? That's suffering. Appreciative joy comes in and says, like, bother all that. Look for well-being and just praise it. Like, that's good. And just leave yourself out of it. And so the sequence of practices here is interesting. The first of the Brahmaviharas, metta, basic friendliness or loving kindness, establishes this foundation of well-wishing in the heart, radiating kindness. The second meets the inevitable sufferings with that kindness and comes as compassion. I care about your suffering. Having seen suffering, we are sobered. We're then instructed to see its opposite and to see well-being, to see goodness as it's arising, and to let the seeing of goodness blossom in our own being as just like a pure joy. And it's a delicious kind of joy because you don't have to own it. You don't have to maintain feeling good, right? Like karmic conditions change. All you're doing is celebrating good fortune that you see. in this way, very beautifully, it's not dependent on your own conditions. I could myself be in a very difficult moment in my life, but I could be very happy that you're doing well. Right? And that's wonderful. Please do well so that I can feel happy for you. And having touched each of those points on the curve, the fourth quality lands it again back at the midline. We'll talk next week about equanimity. The fourth of these Brahmaviharas is exactly the quality that brings the two sides together. It says, I can connect with suffering without being thrown off balance. I can connect with well-being without grasping or being thrown into jealousy or off balance. And what that means is that my relationship to pleasure and pain is also shifting. And it starts to come into this beautiful equilibrium of the heart or balance of the heart that in a certain way is a beautiful maturity. Equanimity is a quality considered to be very, very close to liberation. It's the last of the distinct kind of personality or energetic qualities to mature before liberation happens. And when equanimity is really established, it's considered kind of like the doorstep to nirvana, to full unbinding. Because already to get rooted into equanimity is to have found such a different relationship in ourselves to fluctuating experience, to pleasure and pain. And we do this through insight, through discipline and perseverance, but we also do it through these beautiful practices of encountering suffering and joy and holding them both with a kind of spacious warmth. The last thing I'll say about appreciative joy is that it is a hint toward the most important of the trauma resolution practices, which is that central to the symptoms of trauma is a pervasive orientation toward the negative. When there's been trauma in a system, it tends to remain vigilant and on alert for threat. It's almost a definition of trauma, is that a past threat is not known as past, but continues to haunt the being now. So anxiety and fear and vigilance and frustration and freeze are all these qualities that remain in the system long after the particular insult has passed. That's a definition of trauma. In this way, the antidote to this pervasive attention to the negative is to notice the positive, is to notice pleasure. And not just to have a positive outlook, which is a start. I'm not very good at it, but I hear it's a good thing, looking on the bright side. But the thing that's important is the feeling, is actually the felt sense of getting to drop my guard, my vigilance, for some moments, and to land in contact with ease. It's more contact with ease than processing pain that resolves trauma symptoms. Because what I actually need is for the nervous system to come out of fight and flight and freeze.
Can you repeat it?
The way out of trauma symptoms is contact with pleasure. Because processing directly pain can be useful in lots of aspects of my process, but it still consists in turning my attention toward what's wrong. And that's the habit that's already getting in the way of well-being. And so the foundation that I would say should happen before deep process of painful experience is really possible. The foundation is learning to shift my attention away from threat into the felt sense of well-being, even a little bit in this moment, and that shift allows the system to deactivate, to come out of fight and flight, to come out of freeze, and to return to basic presence and human warmth. That's the thing that heals. And then from that strong foundation, then deeper material can come out and be processed in a way that is more likely to lead to deep resolution. And so appreciative joy and metta, the two sweet qualities, and compassion even, the sweetness in compassion, all of the heart practices are part of, and I would say particularly those that bring us into contact with pleasure, are part of this healing sequence. It's part of why it's so good just to come and sit with good people. To be able to close your eyes and land in yourself and know that for this half hour or this hour, you can just be here and you're welcome here. Or you're in your seat and it's just okay to sit. And all the things that need attending to will get attended to later or not, but that's not our worry right now. And I can tune into what feels right. Tune into that there's goodness happening all around me. And as I contact that, something in my musculature really begins to settle. So from appreciative joy, contact with celebration of well-being, then equanimity is the cooling quality. From that base of contact with pleasure, then the system can really just relax and arrive in a profoundly settled way at the center of the being. So we'll go into equanimity more next week. Thanks for listening. And any thoughts and feelings here? I'll apologize a little bit for squirming. My butt is sore. I taught for 8 hours in a row today, already before coming here, sitting on these little cushions. So I'm a little tired of the sitting posture. Not to mention the sore voice. So you can have compassion for that, but joy, because I really liked doing it. Butt joy. That's a whole nother topic. But I appreciate it when it arises in others, you know, or myself. Thoughts here? Please. Here.
I was thinking about the meditation and then what you were saying just now. And this idea of worth. And then, I don't know, something around just the people I was reflecting on, and I'm like, well, they're well, but no, but yes, but no. Mm-hmm. You know, there was kind of
totally
this, like, back and forth with different people I was thinking about. I don't know, I guess I was sort of thinking about then worth being like well-being. Like, I mean, I guess I'm kind of sort of trying to figure out, like, the sense of, like, people don't have worth, but then that's how I'm kind of viewing it.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's a good question. What does worth mean in relation to people, you know? In the early Buddhist texts, there's a phrase that gets repeated that certain beings, this is particularly directed toward, like, you know, honorable monks and nuns who are keeping the vows and maintaining the religion, etc. It says, you know, those who are worthy of gifts, worthy of honor, worthy of respect, etc. So worthy is different in a certain way than worth, to me. Maybe I'm splitting hairs, but when I hear worth, I think about an intrinsic goodness. You know, are people basically good? Is what we're saying. And I would essentially be like, yeah, people are basically good, and it's the wrong question, right? It's not, are people basically good in their intrinsic essence? Because in Buddhism, We're not orienting toward people's intrinsic essence. We're orienting toward their actions and their experience of suffering. So it's like, sure, everyone has worth. No problem. But what's actually happening is that people are suffering. And that's a whole different question. And believing that I'm not worthy, that's suffering. So it's like, sure, everyone has worth. The most important thing to do with that is to heal ourselves from the idea that we might not have it. And that's just a basic healing step toward like self-love, essentially, or self-acceptance. And that's important because so many of us think that we suck in various ways. And we're just wrong about that, right? We're comparing ourselves with others or with an ideal or with any number of things. And in some way, what we're just saying is we're not happy, which would be a more accurate thing to say. Right? And so that's a little more on the worth question. But I think what you're suggesting, that there's some connection between what we think of as worth or worthy and kind of basic well-being. Mostly, I think that it's that the worth thing is kind of the wrong question. That it doesn't quite get at the heart of it, but it's something that we worry about. Something like that.
Like with success, like a lot of people define success as like where you're doing well and
happy.
Should be worth.
Right. Right. What's your net worth? You know, $30 and change for me, you know, who knows, right? That is one definition of worth that I think is, of course, really problematic, right? If you have material success, then you have worth, right? Or if you have, you know, whatever, like social success or whatever, you have worth. Any of those things is a trap of comparison. So we want to notice that and just to notice the state that gives rise to comparison, really. Yeah. Other thoughts here? Anna?
You alluded to the difference between mudita and gratitude.
Yeah.
Can I expand on that a little bit more?
You know, gratitude's a curious quality. It's not one of the Brahma-viharas. It could be. It's really popular nowadays. And I'm a little curious why, you know, in our profoundly wealthy social system here, of all the heart qualities, gratitude is the one that got popular. As if it's useful to develop a quality of being thankful for all that I've been given. Maybe it is. But I'm curious about it. It's actually not one of the old qualities. It's not one of the heart qualities. And I think that's possibly because in a certain way, if we think about the early system, the practice that householders are supposed to develop is generosity, is giving, and letting go of resources by giving them away, especially to support monastics, monks and nuns. And the practice of monastics is to receive whatever is given without grasping or attachment. And so you might say that gratitude would be part of the practice of monastics. And I think that in the early system, that's where it would live more distinctly than part of the practice of householders. But for us moderns, I'm cautious about the possibility that practicing gratitude could amplify a kind of blindness or entitlement in relation to the resources that have come to me. And that being thankful for the amount of privilege that I have is not exactly the quality that I want to cultivate in relation to my privilege. I'm actually more concerned with cultivating renunciation in relation to it. Noticing it, noticing its systemic effects, and, you know, letting some of it go. So I think that appreciative joy in place of gratitude would be a way of saying, I see my own, in relation to the self, would be like, I see my own good fortune. I celebrate that, but I don't grasp it. I don't try to hold it. And so then I'm not focused that much on celebrating how much of it has come to me, especially as a householder. If I have a lot of good fortune, I want to ask myself, upon whose back is my good fortune resting? And who could I give it to? Right? Who can I support with my extra resources? And who is suffering so that I can have this awesome lifestyle? And I'm more interested in those questions than I am in formal gratitude. That said, you know, doing gratitude practice can be awesome. And you know, recognizing good fortune can be an antidote to the pervasive sense that everything is bad. Right? So if I'm depressed, and I think that everything's really hard in my life all the time, it can be really good medicine to, you know, write down 5 things I'm grateful for at the end of the day and email them to a friend who sends their list back to me. A little gratitude exchange. It's a beautiful practice. And it might remind me that my negativity bias, my orientation toward what's wrong, is a misperception. Right? And that actually a lot is right. So in that sense, it can be, I think, really good medicine. But I wonder if it's... I have some hunch that it's appropriately not one of the 4 Brahmaviha divine dwellings. This isn't an agreed-upon topic. My teacher Eugene has said straight out that he thinks that gratitude should be the 5th Brahmavihara. And I can go with him there. But he also said that, when I first heard him say that, it was somewhere in the late 90s. It was before privilege as a critique existed. So our whole community has shifted, actually, out of a kind of a less awake celebration of our own good fortune as privileged people. And I think that's a good thing. Other thoughts before we close?
Well, just about gratitude.
Yeah.
I guess I'm thinking, like, I most strongly feel gratitude, like, when I'm really feeling my suffering, like, then, and it's being, like I'm thinking of therapy, like, when I'm, like, being seen in my suffering, or when I'm being, like, held in my community, and I'm hurting.
Yeah.
And then that's when I feel like an upwelling of gratitude.
Yeah.
And I don't think it comes from like, oh, this is my, these are my things and this is my privilege.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a, I don't know, it just feels like a very natural kind of emotion. It feels like a natural, it feels like a, I'm thinking like, oh, like a dwelling of the heart. Yes.
Yeah. I like that a lot. Really, and it's, I think certainly that's the more wholesome side of it, where I'm, being an aversive type, perhaps emphasizing a different critique of it here. When I hear you say that, it just sounds beautiful, and like, of course.
It feels beautiful. It feels amazing.
Yeah.
It's like, and especially when you're feeling really bad, you know,
right?
And then suddenly it's like a little door opens or something,
yeah.
And then you can feel that in the midst of the bad feeling, you know, feels gratitude.
I like this a lot.
Mm.
And, I like how, in a certain way, it's the, you know, it's the response to someone showing compassion toward you.
Mm-hmm.
So because your friend or your therapist or your community had this divine quality of compassion, you know, it's pointed towards someone. At the moment it gets pointed toward you, you receive that care in this in this wonderful way.
Mm-hmm. You know. Is there a grasping to it?
I don't know. One would have to see. You know, maybe, maybe not. But maybe if there were, it would still be a different quality. Like, you could still receive it, and then maybe you, you know, get hungry for more of it, like, you know, and then you want more, but maybe you don't. Maybe it's just like you receive it when it comes, and it's like a gift from beyond.
It's equilibrium. It's like you get the
maybe,
dose that you need.
Maybe you're balanced in relation to it, and you know. And I don't want to play it down. I mean, you know, when manna comes from heaven, you praise, like, the gods, right? Or God, or whoever sent it. Like, it's important to receive the gifts that are given to us, you know, with appropriate praise. Maybe even gratitude isn't a distinct thing unto itself, partly because it has elements of some of the others in it. It has elements of appreciative joy. It's probably closest to that one. But it's also, you know, it has elements of compassion toward our own suffering. It has elements of metta, like basic love, in it. And the quality of praise shows up in different places in the Buddhist system, where one would praise, you know, the Buddha or the Dhamma or the Sangha or the community or these things for their good qualities. And I think in that praise is also aspects of gratitude, you know, for being part of the system or being seen or held by the system or by one's people in that way.
I would add that it could also sometimes just be a question of semantics, because I'm thinking, sometimes if I'm doing a gratitude practice, I'm thinking, I'm so grateful that Yael's health has improved. And so that
right.
is mudita.
For sure.
But I file that in, like, that's my gratitude practice.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you know, that's semantics right there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The beautiful Christian writer, I think Annie Lamott,
mm-hmm.
recently wrote a book called, you know, Three Fundamental Prayers, and the title of the book is Help, Thanks, Wow, right? Three basic prayers to the divine, right? And so the thanks has elements of all of this in it. It had praise and receiving and offering and celebration all woven into it. So we'll close for the night. We will meet two more times in this location next week. Is that true?
There are two more Tuesdays in August.
There are two more. Does that mean there are five total?
Yeah.
Yeah, because the first was a Tuesday. Awesome. So we'll finish the Brahma Viharas next week with equanimity, and then we will do one more mysterious topic here to close out the summer and the season and the year and several years. I'll try to figure out when I first started doing this here so I can appropriately celebrate it. And maybe we'll just have a celebration. I don't know. Maybe we'll just bring snacks and just, like, play music and do something or whatever. But we'll do something on the last Tuesday in August. And then the first week of September, we will start in a new space. And I will announce that here in both of the following weeks. And I will send a note out on my email list. And I'll post on Facebook. And I'll put it on my website. And if you don't know how to get any of those notices, then, you know, figure out how to get one of those forms of message. And we'll go on from there. So thanks so much.